Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today on Mages, Sages, and Seers, I'm proud to be interviewing Gail Hasen, who, among other things, has the coolest and cleverest name for her podcast, A Small Medium at Large. Gail has had paranormal experiences since she was a teenager. She attended the Woodstock Music Festival in 1969, appears in the Woodstock documentary, and is featured in the recent book 50 Years of Peace and Music. Today in the research community, Gail is known as a telepath, psychic, and remote viewer, someone who actually sees distant or future events. The chapter on telepathy in Dr. Dean Radin's international bestseller, Supernormal, describes one of many successful paranormal experiments with Gail as the subject. She has contributed to many experiments and papers on paranormal phenomena. In the 1970s, entrepreneur Werner Erhard presented Gail at events to promote the Mind Dynamics Seminars that evolved into Erhard Seminars, Training or EST. Gail has been welcomed into indigenous cultures, including the Huichol of Mexico, the Haida of Alaska, the shamans of Mongolia. In 2012, she was initiated as a Mongolian burial shaman, and in 2014, she was awarded an honorary doctorate from Mongolia's National Academy of Sciences. For decades, Gail has been a subject and contributor to scientists in the paranormal and psi research field. She has led an unconventional life and found herself accepted into other cultures just by being herself, which is incredibly awesome. And I've been looking forward to talking to Gail since we scheduled the show. Greetings and welcome, Gail. How are you?
I'm good. We had a sunny, beautiful day here in Northern California.
Fantastic. Here on the East Coast, we had cold, lots of cold.
Where are you? Are you out of New York or...
I'm near New York. We're maybe 7 to 10 miles away from New York City. We're in Bergen County, New Jersey, which is across from the Hudson, past the Palisades.
Okay. Well, New York, my old stomping ground, so it's good to feel at home here. I have a lot of relatives in New Jersey. So how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic, and wow, what a resume. That is phenomenally amazing, and I love the way you concluded it, just like I love the title of your show. That basically, you're being yourself, and I found that that's a secret that it takes us decades to discover. Just be who you are, you know, with the volume turned up, and everything's fine.
I don't know how to be anything else. Otherwise, my face turns red, and I'm like, I wouldn't know. You would just be able to tell by looking at me I wasn't myself.
So how did your odyssey begin? How did you first become aware of the other world or the other worlds and its denizens?
Well, as a child, I had, you know, certain, I had experiences that not all of my other young friends might have been having. I don't remember actually ever talking to anyone else and saying they've had these kind of things, but when I've met people on these shows, I find there are people that during their childhood experienced something I call flying, and I find there are some other adults who said that's what they called it too when they were young, but I believe it's out of body or astral travel. But I would be laying in my bed in our house in Flushing, and it was a three-story house, and I would just leave my body, and I'd fly around the house and see the other people sleeping, and I'd go from the top of the stairs to the bottom in one leap and jump, and I would just have this really fun thing, and I would just know that at night I might go flying. So I think that's where my first experiences started. And then I feel very blessed that my grandmother and my father were people that didn't, you know, stifle any of those kind of things when young kids tell them things about dreams and stuff. My grandmother was someone who had come from Poland and came, you know, through Ellis Island to New York, and she spoke Yiddish, and she was she had a lot of different spiritual things she would talk about, that she'd speak to the dead people at night, and she'd visit with family who had passed on, and she would tell you things, and it just seemed like, okay, I didn't think that was unusual. And I later came to find that I had a similar experience like her, where I had, as an adult, experiences where I can know that someone is dying or feel in my body the experience of what they're going through while they're dying, even though I have no information that that person is dying at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are some of the things, like, from childhood that carried through to, you know, being the foundation of my person. And the other was that, you know, when I would tell my dad about dreams or knowing, like, someone was going to die, he never said, oh, that's not real or anything like that. He believed in reincarnation. He attended the Theosophical Society. So he
wow.
was a, you know, an open-minded thinking person. In the early 60s, we went and lived in a vegan commune because he realized that, you know, he was looking for a better way of life. And so those were not normal experiences in the early 60s, you know. There were things going on, but not everyone was running off to go be vegans in a commune then. At least I don't think so. We'll find out. Maybe people will call in and say, oh, yeah.
Oh, I don't have the call-in. I didn't set up a call-in for today. I'm sorry. Next time
you're
on.
Oh, okay. So then we don't have to worry.
I'm curious. When were you in Flushing? Because that was part of my stomping ground for many years.
Well, I grew up on 154th Street and 35th Avenue.
And,
okay. I moved to California when I was 15 and a half. So that's when I left the Flushing house. But we did do these little escapades with my dad where we lived in the commune in San Diego. Then we went and lived in Mexico. We were looking in the mountains to do some kind of a health retreat hotel with somebody he was in. We lived in Florida where we were living in a mango grove. I mean, so we always went back home, though, to Flushing as the base. But after my grandfather died, I think I was probably about, maybe, I don't know, 17, I'm not sure. But somewhere in the later years, then the house was sold.
Mm.
But, you know, I used to go back there when I'd visit New York, and I met the people who lived there, and they let me come inside, and it was really nice. You know, it's your first home when you grow up.
Yeah, yes, definitely so. So you probably left before that became my stomping grounds. You also mentioned the Theosophical Society. My background is very similar to yours. I'm Greek, however, I grew up in what the people might call a superstitious culture. So they had names for everything, so I was able to put it in some sort of context. I, too,
right.
Not to share this with too many people because I had a difficult time. And my first public talk outside of people's salons, which is where mediums back in the day would, and maybe still, you know, do their thing, was at the United Lodge of Theosophists on the East Side in the 70s, I believe.
Mm-hmm. So we left, I left New York in 71, and that's when I took the mind dynamics course when I was 15 and a half with,
mm-hmm.
15 and a half, 16, maybe I was 16 already, with Werner Erhard, and we were his second class he'd ever taught. And in that class, we were taught techniques to what I now have come to learn a whole bunch of years later in the 90s when I meet, 1998 when I meet Dean Radin and Russell Targ. Up until then, I had only had the experience of working with this Werner Erhard and these people that taught these courses there. But for almost 2 years, I voluntarily did medical diagnosis
mm-hmm.
by being given the name, the age, and the city that a person was in. And then they had taught you how to sort of build a workshop in your mind, and you would go to that workshop,
yes.
and you would take your mind, and you were supposed to be bringing it into the, I think it was the alpha state, I can't remember,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, this is 50 years ago, but you were bringing yourself into different states of mind, and when you got down to the alpha state, I think it was, that gave you the ability to do what now I know is called remote viewing, and I would see these people's bodies. I would go inside and see what it was going on in their body. And I would know all this medical information that I had been raised with no doctors, so I had no medical experiences at all in my life at that point at 15 and a half, you know. So I would be telling them.
That became the Silva course, too, the Silva Mind Dynamics. Jose Silva did the same thing.
That,
he breathed alpha.
Yes, and this group called Mind Dynamics, I think they some of it stems from the Silva. I'm not sure because they all sort of took from each other to
yes.
make their own courses. You know, I think, and they used on you know old you know on Rosicrucian things, all kinds of different. They pulled from everywhere. And but they did give you these amazing tools and experiences doing these different, you know, workshops and classes that they offered. You know, after the course, you could continue on learning other things. And I wasn't happy with the organization, and I left after the 2 years of volunteering there. But I'm grateful for all of the experiences I had, and for the fact that they gave me tools to access things that I was actually doing already.
That is awesome.
That makes sense?
That makes a lot of sense. And a lot of people get disillusioned with the organization, but they do teach you, you know, if you use them for growth, a lot of really
exactly.
useful techniques. I found the same in my life. The number of organizations that I allow myself to be like associated with are less than half a hand. But I've learned from a lot of organizations, and I've learned a lot of skills by studying with them. It's just that again, I guess I'm not an organization type of person.
Well, I want to answer something to that also, which was, I was having a what I would consider a possession, or I think that would be the right term, but back then all I could say was something's trying to get in my body and I don't want them there and I'm scared. And this organization did not help me when that scary experience happened, because I was looking inside a lot of diseased bodies. And they didn't teach you anything about protecting yourself when you did that. Because, you know, this was the beginning of it. You know, I'm sure they learned more mm-hmm. later on. But for them not being there, I never did any more formal, any kind of psychic remote viewing, anything ever since that time until 1998, when I met two scientists who I felt, well, this is for science. I'm not getting paid. It's also volunteer. I'm happy to do this. Nobody's making money here. Everybody's
right.
doing this to research information. I could be helpful to them. This is a good thing. So I did not do that for all those years, except for the natural things that happened to me, the dreams, the seeing the future, the knowing things before they're going to happen, you know, all those regular things that were normal for me. I could sit down with somebody I hadn't seen and tell them everything that happened to each person in their family. I don't know where the information comes, but all of a sudden it just kind of flows out of me. Well, those are the things I continued to do, but I never continued with any kind of organization or formal anything, or, you know, I didn't hang out a shingle. Or And then I ended up with these two scientists, and I learned even more about myself again, because mm-hmm. they put me in these experiments that, you know, they needed to collect data for different things or whatever they're, you know, I'm usually not up to understanding all the scientific information. It's like over my head some of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned about how I function, because I didn't know I could do the things they asked me to do, or that my body gave off different physiological numbers because of me operating sort of in a, you know, psychic state, or, you know, I'm just saying, I learned a lot from them, and I'm really grateful for the experiences I've had with them over all these years.
And you still call yourself a medium. A lot of people have switched to the word channel. Back in the day when I was very active in the New York psychic community back in the 70s, I was a deep trance medium. I could also do light trance, you know, or no trance.
Wow.
But back then it was deep trance mediumship. Now hardly anybody I've encountered still calls himself a medium. So thank you for keeping that in there. And again, I love how you put together the title of your show. That is like art.
It's the title of a book I wrote after I met Dean and Russell, and I told them all my stories. They told me I should write a book. And so that's where the title came from. So that's what I put onto the podcast show. And I'm hoping to, I haven't gotten the book published yet, so I'm kind of working on that right now. That's my February focus, is to get something happening. And if it doesn't, I'm at a publisher, they're looking at it. if they reject it, then I've decided I'm just going to go to self-publishing. But that is the title of my book, A Small Medium at Large. And I never thought of myself as a medium. It's just that this title came about. But then I've been doing this shamanic cleansing and healings with people, and all of this medium stuff comes right up for me. So I can't deny that I'm not a medium. I think I am. But it's not like going into, you know, deep trance, like what you were saying.
Uh-huh.
It's more of when I take my shamanic objects and I play my jaw harp and my drum and I have the person sitting there, it's sort of like I step out of the way, and then information about, like, usually someone's come to visit me as, you know, a friend or a family member, and it's because they might have lost someone and they don't feel, like, complete, or they just feel they just need to have some kind of contact with something.
Mm-hmm.
And I always tell them, I don't know, you know, I don't charge money to do this. I do this because if there's any way that there's something that comes through that helps the person, or something in the sounds that we do that brings up spirits of any kind of healing or nature of something that might help them, then I feel we've done a great thing. But I haven't done anything. I just sort of step out of the way. So months after, and I see the happy face or the person who looks lighter, and I realize that when it's not much, but I may say a few words about the person or feel a bodily feeling like, oh, they used to go like this, and or they like to do this thing. And when it hits home, I realize I really am touching on the spirit of this deceased person. And mm-hmm. I can't tell you how or guarantee that it would always be that way, but that's how it's been for me so far.
And may it continue to be so. And shamanism, that too, that's a more obscure type of path. I also have learned a lot from the shamanic path, and I consider myself a shamanic in what I do. How did, like with me, the shamanism came from Greek mythology, basically. I was exposed to it as a kid, and as soon as I heard about native shamanism, I saw the parallels. So that opened the door for that, and I studied different indigenous cultures and what they did. But how did your journey through shamanism begin?
Well, first, I just want to say, you did say you're Greek, right?
Yes.
So no wonder the Greek mythology would be resonate for you.
Yes, certainly.
You know, exactly. For me, it's a little, you want me to tell you how it all happened is,
uh-huh.
I didn't know that was going to happen. I did not plan to be initiated as a Buryat shaman by a Mongolian shaman who was visiting. I did not know these were things were going to happen, but I'll tell you how it all began, which was a way back, I don't know, this early 2000, I don't remember what year exactly, and getting involved in working at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and I was helping out to give a ride to a woman who was coming up there to attend a conference, and it turned out she was a woman who held a conference called Shamanism and Alternative Modes of Healing, and her name was Ruth Inga Hines, and she was a Berkeley professor and most knowledgeable in the Asian shamanism. Like, she was like brilliant in these subjects, mm-hmm. and she held this conference once a year, and she would have invitations. She would invite shamans from all over the world, and so in the 1-3 days that you were there, you could see shamans from like 5 different cultures at one time and experience their ritual or ceremony. They'd have translators. You would participate and interact together, and I just thought it was like, you know, lovely. I had met shamans before with the Huicholes in the mountains of Mexico, and I'd had shamans do healing on me because I had cancer at the time, and I was in my 30s. So this is like 30 years ago.
Uh-huh.
So this is my first experience working with shamans was really in my 30s, way before I found out about this conference, and having them work on me before I found out I had cancer, and then on subsequent visits when I found out I did have cancer. And so that was my first, like, shamanic thing where, oh, yes, I want the shaman to work on me. Yes, you know, this is, I want this feeling of, it felt so, you know, this kind of a euphoric or wonderful kind of feeling after a shamanic cleansing, or just the visions you might have when you're experiencing the shaman with you. So that was, but I never thought in my mind that I was going to become a shaman. I was just enjoying what I was experiencing and learning in these cultures and being with these shamans. Then my friend Russell Targ takes us to meet a very famous, he's one of the most famous remote viewers, Ingo Swann.
Mm-hmm.
And Ingo Swann, who's passed on now, when I went to his house with Russell, it was the first time I met him, and it was in the back, I think it was the Bowery in New York.
Uh-huh.
And he had all these magnificent celestial paintings he had done all around the room we were in. And we were sitting there, and him and Russell were talking about different things. And when we're finished, we get up to leave, and he looks at me and says, you know, you're a shaman. And your problem is you don't know how to act like a shaman, and you don't know how to be a shaman, but you are a shaman. And I thought to myself, what a weird thing to say, and it never even occurred to me years later, you know. So more years passed since that. You know, I'm giving you the full history here.
Uh-huh.
And I continue working with shamans in this conference once a year, and it was always on, I think it was Labor Day weekend, I think. And it's Labor Day. Anyway, and it went on. This conference lasted for over 30 years, and it's still going on now. But, of course, the woman has passed on, and some wonderful people, including myself, had participated for a few years to keep it going and, you know, work together. And while she was alive, she had this group of Mongolians come. And I was sitting there in the conference. And by the way, she was the first person who told me I needed to get up and talk, that I needed that I had to share my stories, and that I really had something to say, she said. And so it was my first invitation to speak and talk to, you know, 100 people and show things and talk about different experiences I had. So nobody had ever told me to do that before. So she opened up doors for me in that world too. But she says, Gail, go upstairs. Because this is in a center, so you sleep upstairs, and then downstairs you have your conference. She says, go, this is in San Rafael here in California, go upstairs, there's a group of 6 Mongolians up there, and their translator hasn't arrived. So I want you to go up there, tell them to unpack their suitcases, show them where the food and the bathrooms and everything is, and then tell them they've got to be ready tonight at 7 p.m. to give their presentation and ceremony. And I looked at her and I said, what? I said, I don't speak Mongolian. How am I going to do this? Well, when I went up there and I was there with Shaman, his name was Zorik Batar, and he's also unfortunately not with us anymore too. He opened up, I had him, you know, open up his case so we can put the stuff, you know, I'm doing everything, you know, with charades and motion and whatever, right? And I'm bringing them the food and showing them where the food is and this and that. And we're all smiling at each other. They're speaking in Mongolian. I'm speaking in English. And we open up the suitcase, and there's no clothes in there. It's only full of shamanic tools. It has his drum. It has the full bird. I don't know if it was a rape. I'm not sure what kind of bird it was, but he had some kind of a bird in there. You know, the full bird with the head and the feathers, everything there complete, intact. He had a hat that he wore that was made out of a turtle that was like the whole front head of a turtle with all feathers coming out the back.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't find any clothing. There was no clothing. And I invited them to come and stay at my house after the conference was over. And this, like, sealed our connection. And they came again another time and gave another presentation, and they said, we're going back to Mongolia, and there's going to be a 800-year celebration of the Mongolian Empire, and we would like to invite you to come, Gail. So I went there.
Wow.
And I went to 2 conferences there. I spoke there at 2 conferences. The first one I went by myself, and the second one I took my husband and 2 of my 3 kids, who are adult kids, but my daughter was a teenager then, so and we had an incredible, magnificent, just unbelievable experiences being there and traveling there. And both times, I love the people and the country and the whole being in Mongolia. And I met shamans, fire shamans, shamans of the wolf tribe. I mean, I met so many different shamans. And in Mongolia, it's like one of the oldest shamans of the world. This is Genghis Khan was considered a shaman and practiced shamanism. Yes, so this is how it dates, how far it dates back. In fact, the jaw harp and I think the mirror that I, well, right, we're on talk show, not a Zoom. I was going to show it to you. these are tools that you see in the museum. So that's how old this is. And there was a point where I think shamanism was considered a religion in Mongolia. It was shamanism and Buddhism. So these are the people I meet to introduce me into the shaman world. So at the end of that second conference we went to, which was in this incredible national park in Mongolia, I came home with a huge fox hat all made out of foxes. We meet Zagda, and she has been initiating Mongolian people into shamanism for her 63rd initiation. And I think I'm her first or second only American person that she ever initiated. And she had come here to, but this is, I don't know if up to date right this minute, but up till 2015, yes. And she had come to my house after we met her at this conference, and she stayed here for a week, and then she was going off to Chicago to see other family and Mongolians. And while she was here, she left to go to Chicago. She came back the next day. And I said, I thought you were leaving for Chicago. And she said, no, I saw spirits around you, many spirits, and I need to turn you into a shaman now.
Oh,
and
wow.
I said, okay. She said, it's a lot of work. We need preparation. And you have to invite your family and your friends. And you have to make all these things for your shaman tools and your clothing. I'm going to tell you that we did all of this for 6 days straight with not one English translator. And she would think of something in her mind that she wished she had for the ceremony. And I would go up to my collection of Mongolian things that I've been getting from visitors here and from me going there twice. And I would appear with the exact herb that she wanted to burn or the seashell that she needed or whatever it was that we needed. And I didn't know exactly how it was working for her, but for me it was working because I seem to have an ability to be able to read minds a lot. But I'm realizing now that research should look into the fact about telepathy, that how could I be communicating so perfectly with a few different cultures I've been in where there is no language between the two of us. I'm thinking only in English. She's thinking only in Mongolian, but we're reading each other's minds. So she had a film crew that came to my house, I think about a week after the initiation, and they were Mongolian students at SFSU here. And she had them come up and interview her, and everything was in Mongolian. But she had me put on my complete shamanic clothing and sit next to her and play the jaw harp. And then this man asked her, how did you communicate to Gail when you don't speak a word of English? And that's when I found out her answer, which was, I don't know how we did this, she said, but I would just think in my mind and Gail would be there inside my brain. And that was the description.
Wow.
And so we went through.
It sounds like your life, people were able to recognize your talent and help you cultivate it, which is a rare gift from the universe. So I'm glad that you got it. We've had, I might have met Ingo back in the days when I used to go to John Keel's things in the city, but we have plenty of folks as regular guests or hosts on the channel that were friends with Ingo. So thank you for more Ingo stories. He seems like a remarkable person.
I have to say, I went to visit him a couple other times, and this was, you know, towards, you know, the more end of his life when he was dealing with different, you know, ailments and things, and I wanted to bring him flowers before I came to his house, and I just went to the florist, and you know in New York they have those gorgeous arrangements all on those corners, and there's as many flowers as you can pick from, and they're the most reasonable price, one of the only things in New York that was ever reasonable, and I'm looking, and I see this bouquet of Gerber daisies. And they're orange and pinks and just vibrant, beautiful colors. And I say, oh, my God, that's the one for Ingo. And I go to his house, and I have this bouquet in my hand, and he opens the door, and he said, oh, my God, you brought me my most favorite flower. That's my flower, the Gerber daisy. And so I felt so thrilled to know that I could feel what flower would be his and give this to him and for us to have this nice visit. And we had to go to the store to pick up some prescriptions or something for him. So we were walking down the street, and he's one of the only people I've been with where I could have this great experience where sometimes, you know, in New York, you're getting hit by so much energy. The people are coming at you left and right there. And when you're sensitive and you feel other people's stuff like me, where I kind of become like a sponge, you know, I can't control that. It just happens, right? So we're walking down the street and someone walks by, and all of a sudden I get that feeling inside me like a whoop, a whop, like it feels like a wall hits you for a minute.
Uh-huh.
And he just turns to me and he says, yeah, that person is going to die. And I mean, it was like, I felt like my soul guy, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I found like my, you know, mutual buddy about this kind of stuff. So I was so grateful for that. And then every time I went to New York, I would call him, but if he wasn't up for a visit, so we would just have a phone visit.
Uh-huh.
I have here at home, I never knew that they would do so well, but I planted Gerber daisies that I call Ingo. And I've had them for years now. And whenever they bloom, they're bright orange ones. And I always say, and I always just sort of say, thank you, Ingo, and this is, you know, this is my memory for you. So I just had to share that little story.
Well, thank you. I'm very grateful because again, I if I met him, it was something John Keel was doing, so those were usually pretty busy. but I've heard so many stories about him that I feel like I know him like a dear friend. So this was a very pleasant surprise, and it's amazing again that you had the gift of being able to communicate without words. So the universe provided people who you didn't need to physically speak to, but managed to convey this information. And coming from a culture that still has many shamanic elements surviving through the folk magic and the folk beliefs, it is a great honor to be included into the culture without like having to marry into it or do something like that. So I'm impressed.
And you know what else? It was the best thing that happened to me. The way I felt after that shamanic initiation was like I'd finally gotten my certificate.
Mm-hmm.
I had never gone to high school. I'd never gone to college. I was given an honorary PhD from the Mongolian Institute of Science.
Awesome.
I was very honored to receive that. But it was nothing like what it was when she did this shamanic initiation. There was something there that I realized I had not honored myself or honored my gifts or acknowledged myself in that way, in the way that she saw. And it was a very important thing because sometimes it's hard to, you know, like when you read my bio, I keep thinking, is that me, you know? Who could that be, you know? That can't be me. I'm from Florida, you know? But she gave me something so powerfully wonderful that, and I was not asking for that, and that is also the way I've always seemed to operate in my whole life, is that the universe has been the one that always protects me and gives me these amazing little experiences. So I'm very grateful to the universe. Some people call it God. Some people call it goddess. Whatever it is, I just say universe because I don't really have the actual words that fit what that, it's that kind of giantness feels like.
I usually use the term universe too, or I'll say Mount Olympus, because for me that represents kind of like the highest. But it's hard to find the exact word for that, but it's somewhere greater and somewhere divine and somewhere where things
right.
are make more sense. And so I get what you're saying. Well, that is amazing. And that wasn't the only shamanic initiation that you got. It might have been the most dramatic, but you've been initiated into other indigenous cultures as well.
Well, I've had experiences, but no shamanic initiations.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I've had shamans that come here and we practice and do all kinds of unusual rituals. And, you know, we've walked on hot coals. We've walked blinded through my orchard, you know, on 15 acres with you're blindfolded and you have to use your other senses to get around. We've done, you know, putting hot wax down the spine to become in touch with your ancestors and the pains that they've carried that come through in your DNA and are carried into your spine. So we've done those kind of things, drumming sessions, big fire sessions, amazing shamans that have come here from all different cultures. And I just open my house and invite whoever's around to come and enjoy and be exposed to these different things. I also, whenever I could, when my kids were little, because that's how long I've been doing this, I brought people from other countries and cultures into their classroom. Anyone who came to me, I brought them there. And I was on a show about a month ago that I couldn't believe it was like 20,000 views or something, and it was a young people channel. And in it, somebody that was my daughter had grown up with, who doesn't even live in California anymore, heard me on the show, and she ended up being me through Facebook. And telling me that the first thing she remembered was how when I picked them up from school, I'd have people with colorful clothing on in the car. So these adult kids remember the cultures and things that I brought into that classroom just for them to be exposed to something else in Sebastopol.
Wow. What type of shamanism do you resonate most? Because shamanism includes journeying. It includes rituals, and it includes direct participation with the spiritual world. What parts of it do you resonate with the most?
Well, I did take one class with Michael Harner, who wrote the book, The Way of the Shaman.
I remember that.
And yes, I have one of the little pocketbook, you know, right in front of me that cost, you know, $4.99 in those days, or $3.95 or whatever. That's how old the book is I have of his. I did not know that we were going to become friends later in life because of my Mongolians. And so I got to know Michael in a more intimate place, but I had actually met him 15 years earlier when I took his journeying, like you're speaking about, doing of journeying and finding your power animals and your power tools, and it was wonderful. I mean, if anyone's interested in the thoughts of shamanism, I would think that The Way of the Shaman is the first book that they should read. But
right.
I don't have any formal teaching. I've had a very, very, you know, a shaman who's also a professor at the university in Mongolia come and teach me the way that the drumming is used and how the drumming motion, how you move your body with the drum. I've only had people like pass me on that way. Do you know what I mean? I haven't taken a class or except for that one Michael Harner one, you know, 25 years ago or whatever. I haven't done any of that. So I can't say I just find that I use the tools that they give me I've been given a lot of different things. Every time I meet a shaman, they give me some kind of a gift. And those things have become part of the tools that I use. And I just feel that sound and these objects that feel important to me and this clothing is all what I bring to the shamanic thing. And then I just, as I said to you before, step out of the way and let happen whatever happens come through.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have like a formal thing where I do this particular thing or that. I don't. I was trained in Reiki. I'm also a Reiki master. So I just kind of take all of these things and just let them unfold in me however they naturally become. I'm not a student type. Mine are all from experience. That's my learning comes from experiences. And that's why I like to share my stories. And that's why I just started this podcast, because I like interviewing all these different people that some of them I've known for 20 years. Some of them I'm just meeting for the first time. But these amazing things are opening up because of this podcast thing and just kind of putting yourself out into the world. I think sharing stories is an ancient way of communicating.
Yes, it is. And I'm looking forward to exploring your podcast in greater detail. Can you take us on a quick tour of the podcast? What type of people do you speak with and what type of subjects do you cover?
Well, right now I have 10 shows that I have another one coming out on the 19th. They come out every other Wednesday. I'm only posting 2 shows a month.
Okay.
And each show is each one is a different person and a different type of a show. I don't really want to be kind of pegged into any particular, is it all paranormal or is it all remote viewing or is it all, it's not. My last 2 sessions all had to do with, you know, sexual abuse and the experiences mm-hmm. that happened to people. And one is a well-known, is a singer, and the other one is a woman who's been teaching, you know, a therapist that's done amazing healing with people of alcoholism. So we talked all about those different things. But it's always about the intimate things about our life or when they were kids or when I was a kid or, you know, parts of the things that make you who you are today. I like to find out when I have them on my show.
Uh-huh.
And then I've had Dean Radin, I've had Russell Targ. The one that I just had that just came out this last Wednesday, I think you should check it out because he talks a lot about Ingo Swann, is Nick Cook. And Nick Cook is an author, writer, and speaker that lives in England. And we only met because he was told to contact me to interview me about shamanism because he is writing this book about different, you know, different modes. And he wanted to speak to someone about shamanism. And that ended up becoming us becoming continual Zoom and internet friends. And he met Ingo and was assigned to doing I don't want to quote it exactly, but on my show you'll hear, he'll tell about, he got involved with Ingo's family and read all of Ingo's things and was to write his autobiography or quote me on that. Can't remember where they were making a film.
Okay.
But on that show, he talked all about it and he had a very close relationship with all the writing and work and the family of Ingo Swann. So
wow.
If you're interested, you know, so I'm just saying he just aired. And then my first podcast, and I didn't know I was going to do this, by the way. This was not in my mind, just like the shaman thing.
Uh-huh.
All of a sudden, I'm going to do podcasts because to maybe help promote that I'm going to write a book. And the next thing I know, I love doing what I'm doing, and I'm getting really nice feedback, validation, and comments. And it feels so good to know that people are being touched or my laughter makes them laugh. That feels so good to me. You know,
that is
so
awesome.
My first guest was Sally Linefeather, who is at this moment 91, I think. She
mm-hmm.
was 91 in the show. I think she's still 91 because my show started September 1. And she is so sharp and so inspirational. And when she had to get up from the computer to pick out, change the light or do something, she just springs up like she's a woman of 50. And she looks like a woman. I mean, so you see this youthful, amazing woman. You know that she's 91. I'm going to finally hit 1,000 views on her show. I'm very close. I think I need 6 people. So if you have 6 people out there, go on my podcast and see Sally Linefeather. We'll hit 1,000.
Send me a link and I'll gladly share it.
Well, you know who she is. She is the daughter of J.B. Rhine, who is the one who brought parapsychology to the university, to Duke University.
Oh, wow.
And who coined the word, made the word extrasensory perception, ESP. That is her father.
Wow.
He was
that
the
is
one
cool.
with the Zeno. He's the one who made the idea with the cards, with the triangle and the zigzag
lines.
And the circle and the square. And when we went to meet, we went there to meet them, and we got to touch the original dice, and I think I might have crumbled it a little when I touched it. I felt so bad. But they had like a little museum of all their things, and her and I became friends, just like the Ruth Inge Hines, through the Institute of Noetic Sciences, because I was volunteered there. And I was helping put on a parapsychological PA conference. So I was doing all the registration, and Sally was coming in from North Carolina. And she was bringing her new book, The Gift, which is a collection of stories of her mother had collected 20,000 letters from people over the years describing their psychic experiences. And she combed through the 20,000 and made a book of it. And we met, and after I'd read her book and after we got to know each other, she said, Gail, had I met you before I wrote this book, you would have been there in the front page because, she said, and she keeps a file on me there of when I send her stories of things that happened to me. Well, we ended up becoming so close over these years. I've been on her husband's radio show. And anyway, so I wanted her to be my first. I just feel like, you know, we're all not going to be here forever. And so if I ever have grandchildren or anything, there'll be this little history of all these amazing stories with all these unusual people from all walks of life on this podcast that my children or my grandchildren could watch one day.
That is a really wonderful and healthy way to look at podcasting.
Yeah. I thought, this is better than leaving a photo album.
There you go. And what else? What else? You do your thing. You've written a book that's about to be published. You have a podcast. What other ways do you communicate the things that you've learned with the world?
Well, I've spoken at conferences. I did speak at the Rhine Research, which is, you know, Sally Rhine's other father's foundation, or the Rhine Research Center, because all of this still goes on today. If people are interested, they can contact the Rhine Research Center and go online. They have amazing classes and courses that they offer. I was honored to speak there. I spoke in front of 80 scientists, and she wasn't sure how they would go for, you know, shamanism and my stories, and they loved it. So I've loved when I've gone to conferences, and giving talks in front of people. So that, until the podcast, that's really been the most way I've communicated to groups of people.
Oh, that is very cool. And what dreams do you have for the future? Do you see anything in the future in terms of ways that your path could take, or will you just trust in the kindness of the universe, which has been very good to you so far?
Well, if I told you I have no monetary goals. That's not my goal, but my goal is that if I can keep interviewing people on my show, if other people could call me like you, which I found, you know, you Charlton recommended that you and I get together. And,
yes, you did. I'm glad that you did.
I'm so glad too. And at the end, let me know when we have the 1 minute left, because I want to read his poem. I feel that if any of these stories helps a person in any way, even if, you know, 100 people listen and one person has that happened to me and I would like to share that. Oh, I really should get in touch with this, or I should try that person, or, you know, I think I'm going to read that book of the person she had, and it helps them in any way, then I've done what I set out to do. And that's about, you know, the most important part of this is touching each other's hearts and sharing, you know, with each other in whatever ways that we can, you know, help each other. When I've been involved with the We Show people, when I've schlepped down there in a pickup truck with my father all the way to the mountains of Mexico, driving me. Now I couldn't do this, but back then I could. and driving through all that crazy terrain, through all the Mexican, you know, cities, and getting up to the mountains. That's the only place my father drove, was at the mountain, because that we had to be in four-wheel drive. But I brought food and clothing to 150 families that I just collected here. And until you've been in, you know, immersed in, when you're immersed in a culture where there's so much poverty, all you want to do is help them. So I wanted to bring back jackets and shoes to so these children would not be cold in the wintertime. And I bought, you know, like when I was there for the ceremony of the peyote ceremony is an amazing experience. And you can only be invited to something like this. And it's very remote. You know, I bought a ton and a half of corn masa for all the peyoteros because they have no time to grow corn in their fields unless the family takes over during that, because they dedicate their time to the community, which is what being a peyoteros is for 5 years. You know, there's in Huicho, shamanism is a like a 20-year training before they're going to say you can be a shaman.
Right.
Every culture has a different requirements of what you go through and what has to happen for them to consider you, you know, a shaman. So anyhow, so those are, I'm just saying, whatever the things that we can do to be of service to help other people is a very wonderful thing, you know, in our lives.
You brought up a very good point, aside from the other information you shared. A lot of people have the impression that if you're investigating the paranormal or the unexplained or the spiritual, and again, you could choose whatever word resonates with you, that you're raking in the dough. And that, I find that is not true at all. That except for a very small number of people who are like the superstars who might be making who might be raking in the dough, most everybody that's in this field spirituality or expression is in it because they love it and because they can be of service. So that's what this is all about, not about raking in the dough.
Exactly. And I think that's important because, you know, I know that money is not my motivator. You know, I get sometimes people ask me on, like when I've been a guest on other shows, and if anyone wants me as their guest, please send them my way. I always say that for me, when they ask, do you do readings, I don't have anything to sell about my abilities. There's nothing here for sale. And it's for me only, like, if all of a sudden I connect with a person and I feel something or whatever, I share it with them. And that's the way it is. I don't like sit down and say, okay, come to my house at 2:30 and blah, 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 and then you pay me this fee.
Right.
But I don't dishonor any of the people that do that, because people have to pay their bills and make a living, and that for them that's what they chose, and that's okay. I don't judge that. But for me, my father raised me since I was young, and his friends at this, you know, these different theosophical societies and stuff used to tell him, you know, your daughter's a very spiritual daughter, and I didn't know what a spiritual daughter even meant. He always told me, never use what these gifts, you know, he called them his gifts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't take them for granted. When anything ever happens, I'm always like, wow, thank you. I'm amazed I knew that. I don't feel like, oh, yes, I know everything. I can do this. I don't have that kind of attitude or confident approach or whatever. For me, it's whatever comes naturally on its own. And he said, you never, ever take money for that. He said, it's being given to you through the universe, and you just give it back. And because I was told that, and when I tell you, my dad was repetitive. So whether it was veganism or fasting or no doctors, if it was, you know, you don't accept money for doing that, I could never do that. You know, so that's from my upbringing. So, but I don't judge other people who do, you know, they do astrology, they do tarot readings or whatever they do, and they charge a fee for that. They're exchanging energy with the people. That's
course,
all good. I it's just not my, you know, it's just not the
thing.
Way I operate.
Now,
and don't know, but
go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to just tell your audience that the reason that I'm on this show today, and very happily, is because I'm not sure, you and I are trying to figure out how we met each other, but we've never met in person. And I don't know if he saw me on a talk or a radio show or something, but it was way before I ever did a podcast.
Okay.
And I think it was 2 years. It's more than 2 years ago. And he always sends me, you know, wonderful information about stuff. And he's just, I love talking to him. He's the sweetest, kindest man. And I just wanted to read his New Year's card on the show, if I could right now, because I thought it kind of sums up about, you know, important things about life. So shall I do that now?
Yes, that would be incredibly awesome. That'll leave us enough time for you to share your contact information and also for you to leave us with some closing thoughts.
Okay. So What Will You Do in 2022 by Hugh E. Trawlson. What will you do in 2022? Understand that there are only two types of energies available to you. Negative and positive are the energies at play. So choose wisely each and every day. Negative energy deals in hate and blame, and that will bring you only shame. Positive energy deals in love and light, and that will bring you delight. Do you think about what you think about, you bring about. So use your free will to manifest a better world, not just for you, but also for others in this world too. Forgiveness, love, and prayer are words to guide you as you choose. So again, choose wisely, and may God bless you. Hugh Trawlson's card for 2022.
Very
so that's
wise.
The gentleman who introduced us together.
Yes. And I did try to contact him, and I'm going to continue trying to contact him as well.
Okay. So, let's see. So, are we live right now?
Yes, we are. We're live, and we have like 3 minutes left. I included your contact information with the promos, all the contacts you left me. Would you care to share how people who want to learn more about you and all the wonderful things you're doing can find you?
Well, I've come to realize that this seems like the easiest way to find me these days is my daughter set up a beautiful website for me. And on the website, it shows shows that I've been on, so you just click the link and you can hear, say, Jeffrey Mishlove having an interview with me, or you can see my podcasts all listed there and click on those and be able to see any particular one you want, you know, any of the guests that we spoke about, is, you know, 10 there right now. And then there's also photos, so if you want to see Mongolian shamans, if you want to see photos of Wee Chol, if you want to see me when I was looking younger and... And you
yes,
go,
I saw that.
yes, you go to a small, medium, at large .co. So it's not .com, it's .co. And it's just all one word, lowercase, a small, medium, at large. And there they'll be able to click onto anything. You know, it's like a Chinese menu. You can pick what you want.
And the robot just told me we have 90 seconds. Any last thoughts you care to leave with people who are cautious about exploring the world beyond our world?
Open up, and share your stories. Stories are a wonderful way of healing and learning, and also remember to have forgiveness and a loving heart.
Very well put. Gail, thank you so very much. You're awesome, and I can't wait to have you on again. We touched upon a lot of things that happened to you in your life and your path and your gifts. I'd like to explore each of those a little further. And I want to thank everybody who tuned in, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called and you're in our queue, or whether you'll be checking us out on demand later on. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures, and of course a healthy and happy new year. Thanks again, Gail.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Same here. And we're going to close with Mighty Elohim by Linnell Griffin.
Wonderful.
Sound the trumpet.
Make sure he's okay.